pull up a chair. I want you to imagine a lake at night. Not a big American lake. A German reservoir tucked down in a valley in the Ruhr, black water gone still under a full moon in the middle of May. 1943. There's a stone wall holding all that water back, a dam, curved, thick, older than the war, built to look like it would stand for 1,000 years, and coming down that valley below the treetops, low enough to clip a church steeple, is a four-engine bomber with its landing lights on. Not to see the ground, to measure it. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar. Today we're going to talk about one of the strangest, boldest, most downright peculiar operations of the whole Second World War. The night the Royal Air Force went after the dams of the Ruhr with a weapon that skipped across the water, like a stone a kid throws off a dock. Operation Chastise, the men who flew it earned a name that stuck to them for the rest of their lives. The Dambusters. Now before we get down in that valley with them, let me tell you who's bringing you the show today. Today's episode is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story, and believe me, after tonight's story, you'll understand why some things deserve to be remembered and something you can hold in your hand. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's get into it. To understand this raid, you have to understand a man named Barnes Wallace. He wasn't a pilot, he was an engineer, a tall, quiet, rumpled Englishman who had already designed airships and the geodetic structure of the Wellington bomber. That basket-weave airframe that could come home with half of it shot away. Wallace had a mind that just would not stop turning a problem over. And the problem he'd set himself was this. The German war machine ran on the Ruhr Valley. Steel, coal, factories, and all of it ran on water. Water for the foundries, water for the hydroelectric power, water for the canals that moved the raw material. The big reservoirs of the Ruhr, held back by those great masonry dams, were the beating heart of German industry. Knock out the dams, Wallace figured, and you don't just make a mess. You cut off the water, you flood the valleys, you wash out the rail lines and the power stations, and you set the whole industrial region back on its heels. Here's the trouble. You cannot break a dam like that with an ordinary bomb. People had thought about it. The dam wall was enormous. Curved to push the water's force down into bedrock. A bomb dropped from high up would miss, or hit the top, or just chip the face of it. And the Germans knew their dams were valuable, so they'd strung heavy steel torpedo nets across the water in front of the dam, hanging down deep to stop exactly the kind of underwater weapon you might think of using. A torpedo would tangle in the nets and blow up harmlessly, 100 feet short of the wall. Now here's where it gets interesting. Barnes Wallace figured out something that a lot of engineers already half knew, but nobody had ever weaponized. If you put a charge right up against the dam, underwater, the water itself becomes part of the bomb. Water doesn't compress. So the whole force of the blast, instead of going out in every direction and dissipating, gets channeled straight into the wall. He calculated that a charge of the right size detonated at the right depth, kissing the upstream face of that dam, could crack it. Could start a breach that the weight of all that water would then finish. But how in the world do you get a bomb to sit right up against the wall? Underwater, at exactly the right depth, when there's a steel net in the way. You skip it. Wallace had been fooling around, and I mean literally in his own back garden, with marbles in a tub of water and a slingshot made of elastic. He noticed that a spinning object, launched at the right speed and the right height, will skip across water. Same thing every one of us did as a boy on a pond. And a skipping object rides right over the top of a submerged net. So he designed a weapon they called Upkeep. Now everybody remembers it as a barrel, and in the movie it looks like a barrel. But the real thing was a big steel cylinder full of explosive, weighing around 9,000 pounds. Before the drop, a belt drive in the belly of the bomber would spin it, backwards, spinning it up to about 500 revolutions a minute, and that backspin was the genius of it. Drop it at the right height and the right speed, and the spinning cylinder would slap the surface and skip, skip, skip up the reservoir, hopping right over the torpedo nets. When it finally reached the dam wall and lost its energy, that backspin would grab the face of the wall and crawl it downward, hugging the masonry, sinking down the upstream side to the exact depth Wallace wanted. Then a hydrostatic fuse, a pressure fuse, would fire it. Water pressure at 30 feet down, and boom, the water does the rest. It's beautiful, it's absolutely mad, and it's beautiful, but you understand what this asks of the crews. To make the skip work, Wallace's numbers were brutal and exact. You had to release the weapon flying at precisely 232 miles an hour. And you had to be exactly 60 feet above the water, 60 feet, at night, over black mirror flat water that gives you no depth perception at all, in a heavy bomber, a Lancaster, an airplane never meant to be flown down on the deck like a crop duster. 60 feet is nothing. That's lower than a lot of us have ever intentionally flown anything, and they had to hold it steady, dead level, while people on the ground shot at them. They built a whole squadron for this. Number 617 Squadron, formed in secret in March of 1943 at a place called Scampton in Lincolnshire. They pulled in experienced crews, some of the best in Bomber Command, and they gave them a commander named Guy Gibson. Gibson was 24 years old, 24, and he'd already flown something like 170 operations. A short, intense, demanding young man who his crews half feared and wholly respected. They didn't even tell the crews what the target was. Not for weeks, they just drilled them, low flying, low flying, low flying, over the reservoirs and lakes of England and Wales, until the farmers were complaining and the airplanes were coming home with tree branches and, on at least one occasion, the smell of scorched paint from flying through a friendly searchlight beam down low. Now think about that 60-foot problem, because the solution to it is one of my favorite pieces of low-tech cleverness in the whole war. How do you know you're exactly 60 feet over water at night when your altimeter, a barometric altimeter, isn't nearly precise enough that close to the ground? Somebody, and the story gives the credit around a bit, came up with the spotlight trick. They mounted two lamps on the belly of the Lancaster, one forward, one aft, both angled so that their beams would converge and meet at a single point on the surface of the water when, and only when, the airplane was exactly 60 feet up. The navigator would lean out and watch the two pools of light on the water, too high, and the circles were apart. Too low and they crossed. When those two spots of light slid together into a figure eight right under the wing, you were there. You were on height. And the range, how do you know when to release? At just the right distance from the dam. On the Moni Dam and others, there were two towers on top of the wall, sticking up a known distance apart. So they built a little handheld sight, a piece of plywood with a peephole and two nails sticking up. The bomb aimer would hold it up to his eye, and when the two nails lined up with the two towers on the dam, he pressed the button. Plywood and nails. That's the targeting computer. So now you've got a Lancaster thundering down a German valley at night. 150 miles an hour of engine roar. Four Merlins screaming, 60 feet off the water with two spotlights painting the surface. The pilot holding it dead steady. The flight engineer nursing the speed to that exact 232. The bomb aimer with his eye pressed to a piece of plywood. And the whole 9,000-pound cylinder underneath spinning backwards and shaking the airframe like a wet dog. And the Germans shooting up at them from the towers. Let me take you to the night itself, May 16th into the 17th, 1943. 19 Lancasters took off from Scampton in three waves. They flew low the whole way, right down on the deck across the North Sea and over the occupied Netherlands, hedgehopping to stay under the radar, weaving around the known flak batteries. It went wrong immediately, the way these things do. One airplane hit the sea on the way in and tore off its weapon, barely staying airborne, and had to turn back. Another flew so low it struck power lines. Others were caught by flak crossing the coast. Men died before they ever saw a dam. The main force, Gibson leading, made for the Moon, the biggest of them, the prize. Gibson went first. Down the valley, lights on, spots converging in against the guns. He dropped his upkeep. It skipped. It ran true. It hit the wall, and it went up in a tower of white water 1,000 feet high. The dam held. They circled back into the dark and watched the water settle, and the wall was still standing. Second airplane in, Gibson flew alongside it this time, off to the side, drawing the German gunner's fire onto himself to take the heat off the man making the run. Think about the nerve that takes flying into the guns on purpose, with an empty bomb bay, just so your friend has a better chance. That second bomber was hit, badly, caught fire, dropped its weapon late, and crashed beyond the dam. The whole crew was lost. Dam still held.
Third airplane. Gibson and the second survivor both flew escort now, both drawing fire, everybody down in that valley in the searchlights. The weapon skipped, struck true, sank down the face and blew. And still, when the water fell back, the wall stood. They were running out of airplanes. Fourth, run. Same discipline. Same terrible 60 feet. The upkeep skipped up the reservoir, settled against the wall, and detonated. And this time, as they pulled up and turned, one of the crews called out over the radio. The wall was moving, a breach opened in the center of the Moni Dam, and then the whole weight of that reservoir, millions of tons of water, tore it wide open and burst out into the valley below, in a wall of water that swept away everything. The power stations, the bridges, the roads, for miles down the Ruhr. Gibson himself said the moonlight on the water pouring through the gap looked like a river of molten silver. they still had weapons left, so Gibson took the airplanes that hadn't dropped yet and pressed on to the Eder Dam, deeper into Germany, hidden down in such a twisting, steep-sided valley that it wasn't even defended by guns. The Germans figured no one could fly into it, and they nearly were right. The approach was so tight that the crews had to dive down over a castle on a hilltop, drop into the valley, level off at 60 feet, release, and then firewall the throttles and haul back to climb over the mountain at the far end before they hit it. One crew made pass after pass and couldn't get set up. Finally, they got it right, dropped, and the Eder breached too. A second flood roared down a second valley. The cost was staggering. Of 19 Lancasters that set out, 8 did not come back. 53 men killed in a single night out of 133 who flew. Nearly half. 3 more were captured. There has rarely been a raid with a casualty rate like it. And now here's the part where an old pilot has to be honest with you, because history deserves honesty and not just a good yarn. The damage did not win the war. The floods were real and dramatic. They killed well over 1,000 people on the ground, and a cruel number of those were foreign prisoners and forced laborers, workers, held in camps in the valley. The Germans, for their part, were shocked, and they poured resources into repairs. And here's the thing that always gets me. They rebuilt the Moni Dam by that autumn, same year. They pulled thousands of workers off the Atlantic Wall fortifications to do it, which is its own kind of victory nobody planned. But the dam itself was flowing again within months. So was it worth it? People have argued about that for 80 years. As a piece of pure engineering audacity, as a demonstration of what precision and nerve could do, it was extraordinary. It proved that a handful of aircraft, flown with impossible skill, could hit a target that everyone said couldn't be hit. It lifted British spirits at a moment when they badly needed lifting. And it tied down German labor and defenses for the rest of the war, worrying about their dams. But it was paid for in the best cruise Bomber Command had. Guy Gibson got the Victoria Cross for that night. He was killed in 1944 on another operation, still just 26 years old. Barnes Wallace, they say, was haunted by the losses. When he heard how many men hadn't come home, this quiet engineer who had dreamed the whole thing up in his back garden with a slingshot and some marbles wept, and said if he'd known the cost, he never would have started. That's the part I want you to carry out of the hangar tonight. It's easy to love the cleverness of it. The bouncing bomb, the spotlights, the plywood sight with the 2 nails, it's the kind of story that makes you grin at human ingenuity. And you should. But underneath every one of those clever tricks was a 19 or 22 or 24-year-old kid holding a 4-engine bomber 60 feet over black water while people shot at him, doing it because the man ahead of him had done it. And the man behind him was watching. That's the whole of aviation, right there. The brilliance of the machine and the courage of the person flying it, and neither one worth much without the other. The details tonight I owe to the Royal Air Force's own histories of 617 Squadron and to the accounts of the raid drawn from the crews who survived it and the engineers at Vickers who built Upkeep. If you want to dig deeper, and you should, the Royal Air Force Museum has kept the story and the surviving pieces of that weapon on the record. Go read the crew names. Read all of them. They earned that. You can find us anytime at RadioHangar.com. Next time you skip a stone across a still pond, and you watch it hop and hop and settle, think about what a few Englishmen did with that same little bit of physics on a moonlit night over the Ruhr. This is Taildragger. Keep the shiny side up and don't ever stop being amazed by this stuff.